The Exchange's daily podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. No recounts, no runoffs, no too-close-to-call races. New Hampshire's four top contests had clear winners last night.
I am so proud to once again be able to represent the people of New Hampshire and the United States Senate.
Thank you to the people of New Hampshire for once again placing your trust in me.
And today, I think we've proven that New Hampshire wants a better course. New Hampshire needs a better course. New Hampshire deserves a better course.
We know how to bring people together to get things done. And that's what each and every one of you did today at the polls. And thank you.
From the top, those four winners were U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen, Governor Maggie Hassan, former mayor and congressman Frank Ginta, and U.S. Representative Emma Klein Custer. Ginta was the lone top-of-the-ticket Republican to win last night, but once he's in Washington, he'll have plenty of company, with the GOP soon to control both the U.S. House and Senate. Today in The Exchange, who won, who lost, and why? We'll look at the issues and the role of outside money in these campaigns, and we'll examine the national picture, again, as I said, with Republicans retaking control of the Senate and holding on handily to the House. It's a special edition of our Political Junkie Hour with Ken Rudin, and let's hear from you, your reaction to these results, your thoughts about where our state and our nation may go from here. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And our guests for the hour are Ken Rudin, as I said, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. And Ken, welcome back. It's been at least 6 hours since we saw each other. It was
a long night last night.
A long night,
but a great night for the Republican Party.
Well, and Josh Rogers is also here, NHPR senior political reporter. And Josh, a big night for you, too. Thank you so much for being here.
Pleased to be here, Laura.
Well, and Ken Rudin, what do you make of New Hampshire bucking the national trend? That was the big headline of the Concord Monitor today. Most of the country went Republican. New Hampshire, in large measure, stayed Democratic.
Well, I came into New Hampshire a couple of days ago thinking New Hampshire will do what it always does. If there's a national wave, it would follow through. When you look at 2006, you look at 2010, two big respective Democratic and Republican waves, New Hampshire embodied it more than any other state. This time, what I learned from last night's results is that New Hampshire stood up to its independent reputation, the live-free-or-die independent thing, because the national Republican surge and wave that we saw all across the country in the battles for the Senate, in the battles for Congress, in the battles for governor, did not happen here.
So the wave didn't hit New Hampshire. What do you think, Josh? How come?
Hard to say. I think part of it is that the strength of the Democratic candidates on the top of the ticket, Gene Shaheen, was in danger, but her polling numbers were always pretty positive, and she was running against somebody who Scott Brown was underwater in terms of favorability. He obviously tried to hang the unpopularity of President Obama around her neck. That didn't quite work. And Governor Maggie Hassan, as we know, it's very difficult to get rid of any governor here after one term. It happens very, very rarely. She has worked across party lines by necessity, but, she hasn't done anything to really inflame the average voter. And, she had the wherewithal to run a good campaign. And also, I think the Democratic Party in New Hampshire has at this point established itself as the more proficient of the parties at getting the mechanics of winning elections, targeting voters, getting people out to the polls, having the resources to get the job done. That wasn't always the case here in New Hampshire. It is the case now.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit later about resources, not only internally, but all that outside money that came in, gentlemen. And let's talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate race. Scott Brown coming in from Massachusetts about a year ago, deciding to try to take on Senator Gene Shaheen, a well-known, long-established politician in the state. Let's hear from Scott Brown last night and how he framed sort of his loss here in the Granite State compared to big wins for his party nationally.
So let me just say, listen, I want to just say thank you very, very much. It was an honor. It was an honor to carry the flag. And I thank you for the privilege of being the nominee. And I'll just say that we have better days because the Senate is turned Republican, the House is Republican, and I'm hopeful that the president will come back and try to put our country's interests first and be a uniter instead of a divider.
And again, that's Scott Brown, you know, making good of his defeat last night. He took it well, Josh Rogers, and said, hey, at least Harry Reid's going to be the minority leader in the U.S. Senate.
Well, that was one of the main things that Scott Brown talked about on the campaign trail. Gene Jean's fealty to the president and what it would mean to have Republicans in charge of the Senate. That's why national Republicans were excited about Scott Brown running here, is that they thought he had a chance. And, you know, he certainly campaigned hard. How much of his recent arrival here, although he has owned property here and spent his, you know, very young childhood here, how much of that hurt him is hard to say. Gene said this was about issues. We don't really know, but, you know, he came pretty close, and at points last night it was very close, and we still don't really have the final numbers, but I mean it's more like more or less in line with the polling, which pretty steadily showed Shaheen up, you know, 4-ish points for weeks.
Yeah, and, you know, you're right. I'm glad you mentioned that, Josh. There was a moment last night, Ken, right, where the race showed Shaheen ahead for most of the night, but then there was a moment where it was 50-50.
It was, and, of course, the Republicans were very, very excited. They were, of course, blaming the news media for calling the race too soon. Of course, the AP called it for Shaheen much earlier, and then as Scott Brown not only moved into statistical tie with the raw numbers, but he actually moved ahead, the Republicans were saying, you know, recount, and then, of course, they would go back to the Bob Smith Dick Sweat race of 1996. Well, you were wrong then, you'll be wrong again. But as it turned out, there's just not enough reservoir of Republican votes to put Scott Brown over the top.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. We want your reactions to last night's voting results and also your expectations about what may happen next, both here in New Hampshire and around the country. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. One more thing about Scott Brown and Josh, I just have to ask you this because you had it in your piece this morning. Still some speculation that Scott Brown might run for president, and you heard his supporters saying, go, Scott, go.
Oh, I don't know. A lot of people say that. I mean, it would be a tough slog,
after losing twice
and also within the Republican Party, getting through a primary. He did well getting through the Senate primary. He wasn't up against the most formidable candidates, and he did a pretty good job of more or less solidifying Republican support. And I haven't looked through all the numbers, but there were certainly wards and precincts and towns where Scott Brown did underperform other Republicans.
But it kind of makes sense for Scott Brown to think about running for president in 2016 for this reason. He loves running against women. He ran against Martha Coakley for the Senate of Massachusetts, beat her. He ran against Elizabeth Warren, lost to her, ran against Jean Shaheen and lost to her. If Hillary Clinton is a Democratic nominee, this is the perfect opportunity for Scott Brown to make it a foursome.
Well, and maybe we'll talk about the presidential stuff a little bit later in the hour, too. All the media in New Hampshire has been joking that we get a 48-hour rest and then we turn to presidential issues. I do want to also play for you, gentlemen, Jean Shaheen. I think you said in your piece, Josh, that she's won all but one of her races for state Senate, for governor, for U.S. Senate.
Apparently she did lose an early race for the New Hampshire House, I'm told, but she is for 5 for 6. And the race she lost was to former Senator John E. Sununu, a tough candidate, particularly in 2002 when she ran against him. It was a big Republican year, and he won by 20,000 votes.
Let's hear about some of the issues Shaheen says she'll focus on when she goes back to the U.S. Senate.
I will fight for a smart energy policy that focuses on efficiency and new energy technologies. To end our reliance on oil and coal and fossil fuels. I will fight for a minimum wage. ensures that no one working 40 hours a week is stuck living in poverty.
Again, that's U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, reelected last night, talking about some of her priorities when she returns to the U.S. Senate. Gentlemen, let's go to our listeners now, get their reactions to the voting yesterday and what may be ahead. 1-800-892-6477. And Kath is calling from Peterborough. Hi, Kath. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, Laura, thank you so much for taking my call. I called because I'm really concerned about Carol Shea Porter's loss. Our congresswoman was such a strong supporter for the earned benefits of Social Security, Medicare, for seniors, for the veterans and ordinary people. And I'm saying, now what? It's going to be a real strong 2 years of people really have to fighting for those earned benefits. And hopefully Carol will be back on the other side as a congresswoman candidate in 2 years. We need strong people like her.
Okay, Kath, thanks a lot for calling in. And, you know, she talked to Ken Rudin about some of the priorities that Carol Shea Porter said she was fighting for, you know, the income gap, middle class, minimum wage, and so forth. What happens to those priorities now?
Well, that's a great question. Now that the Republicans will control not only the Senate, not only the House, which they added to their numbers, but the Senate as well, with Mitch McConnell as majority leader. So you can talk about, you know, fighting for the minimum wage and fighting for income inequality and issues that basically were downplayed or at least didn't get a great hearing in 2014. But if you have Republican control of Congress and you have a battle shaping up with President Obama, those may not be the issues on the top of the Republicans' agenda. It may be more about energy or perhaps some kind of overhaul of immigration or maybe some kind of tax reform. But a lot of the issues that we heard both Jeanne Shaheen and Carol Shea Porter talk about in their respective winning and losing statements yesterday, these may not be the issues the Republicans are going to take up.
Yeah, and the 1st and 2nd District, it's often said, Josh, that our 2nd District leans more Democratic, our 1st District leans more Republican. We certainly saw that last night.
True enough. And, you know, the 1st CD in particular seen is a real bellwether. And, you know, Carol Shea Porter has her staunch fans, even somebody calling from outside her district.
Peterborough is in the 2nd
District. You know, some of these issues, they're obviously going to be on the table for 2016, assuming Republicans, you know, sort of squelch them in the meantime.
Okay, well, we will hear a lot more from the winners and losers last night. We'll also talk to Frank Ginta later on in the hour. All that's coming up, so stay with us for The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're looking back at last night's election results, both here in New Hampshire and nationally, and what they may mean now that this rancorous campaign season is over. Give us a call. We'd love your reactions, your thoughts and questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, we want to hear from you this morning, your thoughts about last night's results. Ken Rudin is here, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. He helped us cover election night last night. Josh Rogers is also with us, NHPR's senior political reporter. And gentlemen, let's go back to our listeners. And Charlie is calling from Whitefield. Hi, Charlie. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy your show.
Good.
I would like to say that I think you guys are downplaying how successful Scott Brown was. I mean, he was portrayed as the outsider, and he very well may be, and he was expected to lose by a fair amount, and he came very close. As far as bellwether for the country, he was, I went to sleep last night with it at about a 2% difference. That's 1 out of 50 people had changed their minds. You'd have totally different perspective this morning.
Yeah, Charlie. Thanks. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. And I think the Republicans now, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that they're going to get some real progress to happen. But now it's their opportunity to show that they aren't the party of no, and that they're the party of getting things done.
Progress on what kind of issues, Charlie? Can you name maybe
one
or two?
I would say immigration, reforming or doing something with Obamacare to improve that, and I think getting the economy really getting going again without quantitative easing to sort of juice it.
All right, Charlie, thanks a lot for calling in. You know, Josh, he said, look, Scott Brown came in with some disadvantages. He was an outsider. Gene Shaheen is a longtime figure in New Hampshire politics, and he still, Scott Brown did a decent race.
He did do a decent race, and he is an effective retail campaigner. Everybody would admit that. He's energetic. It is interesting that Charlie brought up immigration as something where he might think that Republicans might make progress, because that was one issue where Scott Brown was particularly staunch in terms of saying that the bill that was in the U.S. Senate that was backed by Senator Ayotte, Marco Rubio, John McCain, among others, was something that didn't go far enough and was too soft, basically. So immigration is one area where Scott Brown was really, sort of playing to core Republican voters who have real concerns about, as Scott Brown says, our porous border. He did run a decent campaign. He had the advantage of name recognition, and he did do a pretty good job getting through the primary unscathed. He was under attack from the Democrats from the beginning, and he did all right.
Yeah, and it was a long race for him because he did have that primary. I'm interested in what our caller says, Charlie, about health care, Ken Rudin. I think a lot of people are wondering, okay, now that Republicans have the House and the Senate, what about Obamacare?
Well, of course, many, if not most, of the Republicans who ran for the House promised outright repeal and then replace. Of course, that's not going to happen with President Obama in the White House, and Mitch McConnell and John Boehner know that. But there were still a lot of Democrats who ran mostly unsuccessfully saying that, there are problems with it. Let's make it better. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that if there is going to be some kind of comity between President Obama and the Republican leadership in Congress, it could be on the Affordable Care Act and things, a little tinkering that could make things improve some things. But I was also interested, if we have a second, on immigration, which was interesting because the lesson of 2012 for many observers was that the Republicans will pay a price by ignoring the Latino vote, by doing all those things that just would not allow the 11 million people here illegally to get into the regular society. And so a lot of people said that in 2014, Republicans will pay the price. Well, most Republicans ran against immigration. Most Republicans did not have any kind of significant Latino presence in their district, and they did not pay the price. There were maybe the last time I looked, there were maybe two House Republicans incumbents in the country who lost and had nothing to do with immigration. But the things that worked for Republicans on immigration in 2014 could still come back to bite them in 2016, when there'll be a bigger electorate, more Latinos coming to the forefront, and instead of just maybe this year a Colorado Senate race where Latinos play a big role, it'll be a national electorate, and the Republicans still do poorly nationally among Hispanic voters.
Yeah, it's interesting how the narrative changes, though, because you're right. I remember after 2012, I think we talked about this. Okay, immigration's the big issue. Everybody's going to come together on this because that's the message, and it turned out to be completely different.
And they didn't pay the price in 2014.
Well, that's what keeps it interesting.
Right.
We make predictions and we're wrong. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, gentlemen. Joining us now from Hanover is Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. His research includes misperceptions about politics. He contributes to The Upshot at the New York Times. And Brendan Nyhan, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there's been a lot of focus, Brendan, on the role of big outside money in these campaigns here in the Granite State and around the country. What did you notice about this time around in terms of outside money and the role it played?
Well, it was a huge part of the total number of ads that people saw. So states like New Hampshire were obviously, they obviously faced a deluge of these outside ads. It was hard to even sort through who was sponsoring which ad. They were often from groups people had never heard of before, and they couldn't tell where the money came from or even who the group was in a lot of cases. It's less clear, though, what difference that made. In a lot of cases, these ads are just canceling each other out. So it's not, we often fear that people are buying elections, but you can make a case that these billionaires are getting a terrible deal for their money. They're mostly just spending money to offset each other, and it's a cacophony that people end up tuning out.
Well, I do wonder about that. And that was, again, a narrative that we talked about after 2012, that at some level it is just a lot of noise and nobody is paying attention. But are you saying they had no impact, Brendan, or just not as much as people feared?
Well, it's too early to say, but the best evidence suggests that these things tend to cancel each other out. Now, of course, if one side unilaterally withdrew, those ads might have a lot of have a strong effect on how people vote. But when you take them as a whole, with both sides dumping huge amounts of money in, then you tend to get this canceling out effect. So it tends to turn an election into what we would expect based on the underlying conditions, right? So the campaigns often are basically fighting to a tie, and then what matters most are the structural conditions, which in this case were very unfavorable to the Democrats. So even if the Democrats can fight to a tie in the air war in terms of the, you know, the spending that's out in the air in favor of their candidates, that's not enough when the president is unpopular and they're running in a lot of states that feel very negatively about the president.
Yeah, one other thing that I noticed this year, again, a lot of ads, but a lot of new groups too, Brendan. Who were some of the newer players? You'd see the credit at the end of the ad and you'd go, wow, who's that?
Well, you know, so there were the familiar names, you know, groups associated with the Koch brothers and others, but there are all sorts of groups, and there are often these boutique third-party groups that are set up just to back a particular candidate. So there's a super PAC to help Mitch McConnell get elected in Kentucky and so on and so forth. And that can be a vehicle then for people who want to support that candidate with large dollar donations. It's, again, though, you know, how much that matters to people, I don't know. I mean, we live not only in an age where there are all sorts of ads on TV that are offsetting each other, but people have DVRs. I didn't see very many ads myself because I skipped through them on my TV, and I know a lot of people do that. Now, you can see them in other settings. So one thing people probably noticed this election was those ads showing up in other places, showing up in their Facebook feed, showing up in YouTube when they run the video before you get to watch the one you'd actually like to watch. So there's other ways that they're trying to get in front of people, but it is easier to tune those ads out than it used to be.
One last question for you, Brendan, please. You have also looked at how the media covers elections. What's the big narrative for you in terms of how the media did this time around?
Well, I think the media did about as well as you know, you would hope, which is to say they cover the horse race most, but that tends to be what people, what the media does during elections. There's more knowledge out there now about polling and how to be more sophisticated about who's likely to win. The polls weren't that accurate this time, though. So, you know, in some cases, our forecasts were off, right? If you look at these different sites that try to aggregate polls, in some cases, those weren't as accurate as we'd like because the polls didn't do that well. But, you know, in general, the problem is, and let me just, if I can just make one point about this, the media tends to focus on what their audience wants and what the people who follow politics closely have typically already picked one side they're rooting for. So the political media tends to cover politics more like sports, and you have a team that you root for, and less on helping people make up their minds because the people who are trying to make up their minds about who to vote for aren't that interested in politics in the first place, and they're not following the political news very closely.
All right. Well, Brendan, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor of political science at Dartmouth College. Again, his research includes misperceptions about politics, how the media covers politics, and the role of money. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. What about the big money, Ken Rudin? What's your perception on the role that it played this time around?
Well, you know, that's a fact of life. We're going to have big money, and every new succeeding election cycle will be breaking records. There are different ways of spending money. Of course, in 2012, for example, both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney had the same amount of money. It depends what you do with it. If you want to put into nonstop ads, which, as Brendan said, people seem to drown out the voters towards the end of it. But, I mean, a lot of people use it towards get-out-the-vote operations in the state, boots on the ground kind of thing. So if you spend your money doing the things to get out your vote, knocking on doors, that's one way of spending it. But as he says, with all these ads at the end, it just becomes such a blur with such a difficulty, anything seeping through, that you wonder the influence of it. The thing that concerns people, though, is that a lot of people don't know where the money is coming from, and that's the objection. I think the objection to a lot of money is not so much how much money is being spent, but the source and the origin of it, and that's what concerned people in the outgrowth of the Citizen United case.
All right. Well, joining us now on the phone is one of the victors from last night, Frank Ginta. He's the newly elected congressman from the 1st District. And Mr. Ginta, thank you for being with us.
Laura, it's a pleasure. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. A long night, but here we are. You and Congresswoman Shea Porter have traded this seat a number of times. Why do you think voters decided it was your turn?
Well, look, I think there's some concern and frustration about the economy and jobs. And I think there were some clear differences between Congresswoman Shea Porter and myself relative to accessibility here in the district, and that I think does play a role. People expect to be expect their member of Congress to be available to them, as I think that's a New Hampshire tradition. But I, you know, we had a very good conversation last night, and we're going to work together through a strong transition because that's what the people of the 1st Congressional District deserve. And I appreciate, you know, her willingness to work with me, as I did with her back in 2012.
How do you feel about being the lone Republican holdout of New Hampshire's top of the ticket races? In the other three races, it was all Democrats.
Sure. Yeah. Well, look, I certainly, you know, would have liked to see Walt and Scott do better, but the voters made their choices, and you know, we have an obligation to take the oath of office and govern. And I've worked very well with Senator Shaheen in the past, and I'll continue to do so. Annie Custer and I have a very good relationship, and we'll make sure that we put New Hampshire people first ahead of politics. And you know, I congratulate Governor Hassan and her victory, and we'll continue to work as a delegation to try to improve things here in the great state of New Hampshire, New England, and the country. That should be the goal of everyone after hard-fought campaigns. We have an obligation and a responsibility to govern, and that's my pledge to the people of the state.
Does this say anything about the political character of the state, Mr. Ginta, that it may be shifting more Democratic, or was this just a good year for these particular Democratic candidates?
Well, you know, I think it depends on how you view the outcome of the races. You know, while I was the only Republican at the top of the ticket that was fortunate enough to win, you know, the state House of Representatives went Republican. I believe that the state Senate added a senator and the executive council went Republican. So I think we continue to be in that typical New Hampshire tradition and fashion, somewhat of a purple state. People vote individual, not just party affiliation. And I think that serves to move toward merit-based elections, which is something that I think we need to have rather than you know, these vacillating elections back and forth that either support all Republicans or all Democrats.
And, Mr.
and I think
Ginta,
it does
yeah.
force everyone to work together and try to accomplish the stated goals that the people of our state want.
Mr. Ginta, if you could hold on for just a moment. Ken Rudin,
sure.
Political junkie of national stature, is with us. And Ken, go ahead. You had a question.
Congressman, first of all, congratulations on your victory yesterday. What is the difference? When you were elected in 2010 on that big Tea Party wave, you still had to deal with a Democratic Senate. Now you're coming into Congress in 2015 with a united Republican control of Congress, House and Senate. How does your role change? How does the role of Congress change?
Well, thank you, Ken, for the question. I think it's important for Republicans in Washington to govern. You know, the elections are over. People will take the oath of office in January. The Senate will go Republican. And I think it's an obligation that we have to govern effectively, to work with the president on areas of common ground. And I think that the president, you know, will likely make some statements and comments this week that he will work with the House and the Senate because it's the will of the people of this election cycle. So, you know, again, part of how I approach this is the experience that I've had in business and as a chief executive and as a former member of Congress. I'll bring all of that to the table to try to find individuals, Republican or Democrat, to find common ground on the issues that people are most concerned about. And I think it's right now, you know, economy and jobs is critical for everyone. I mean, every candidate, regardless of party affiliation, was talking about that particular issue, trying to find common ground on tax reform, trying to find common ground on how do we balance the budget and start to reduce our long-term debt. And I do think that there are areas of of agreement.
And you did talk about that in your race this time around, common ground. And Josh Rogers, did you want to jump in real quickly?
Yeah, sure. Good morning, Congressman, and congratulations.
Thank you, Josh.
You know, obviously this is a race where Republicans made much of the unpopularity of President Obama. You know, naturally less emphasized was the unpopularity of Congress, both parties. I mean, what's going to change that?
Well, I think what's going to change that is the fact that while you have President Obama in office for a final 2 years, you do have now a governing majority in the Congress, and it is going to force the executive branch to work in a more bipartisan fashion with the legislative branch. Before, a lot of the bills that were moving through the House of Representatives, including this current Congress, 90% of them, Josh, were passed bipartisanly. That never really got discussed nationally or here in New Hampshire. I brought it up a little bit in my race, as did Congresswoman Shea Porter, by the way. And I think we need to articulate that a little more effectively, that there's a lot more common ground than people would believe. And I think we have, again, an obligation now to find that common ground. And I think the House and the Senate can have the regular order, as to use a D.C. term, to go through the regular process and then find the common ground with the president. And that's the goal that I have. I hope that that is the goal that the newly elected Republican senators will have, because people do want to see progress in Washington and rather than that gridlock that we've experienced over the last 6 years.
So, quick one. Is there going to be progress on immigration? This is something a caller brought up earlier in the show.
Yeah, we'll have to make that a five-second answer, Mr. Gintel.
The president originally said he was going to executive order that issue. I suspect maybe that'll change, so I certainly hope that there's area of common ground on that issue.
All right, and we will talk to you on the exchange, I hope, once you get settled in Washington. Thanks a lot for being with us.
So. Thank
all
you.
Right. More conversation about last night's elections on the exchange. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're wrapping up last night's election results and looking at what may be ahead, especially now that Republicans have control of both the U.S. House and Senate. Here in New Hampshire, we sort of bucked the national trend. Republican Frank Ginto was the only Republican at the top of the ticket to win. Otherwise, Gene Shaheen, Maggie Hassan, and Anne McLean Custer, all Democrats, will all return to their seats. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ken Rudin is here, host of the Political Junkie program, along with Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Gentlemen, back to the phones if we could. And Colin is calling from Concord. Hi, Colin. You're on The Exchange.
Hey, Laura. Colin Bannister, serving on the State Executive Council. How are you?
I'm fine. And I think you won your seat last night. Is that correct, Colin?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Congratulations.
So I think it was a really interesting election. I mean, you got to love the independence that New Hampshire voters showed. First, bucking a national trend by voting Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan and Annie Custer back into office, but also even showing independence within their own ballot. You know, we're going to have a Democratic governor who was elected at a much higher margin than the final polls were showing, who's very popular, who's going to be working with a Republican legislature and a Republican majority on the executive council. And I think that shows that we have an independent state. And frankly, it's different than a lot of what we've seen in the last decade when New Hampshire tended to amplify a national wave. You know, this year people really focused on what was best for them, their own communities and their own state.
Well, Councillor Van Ostern, if I could ask you a question, actually. I got an email here from Liz in Londonderry who says, what happened in the New Hampshire House and Senate, the Executive Council, et cetera? Liz says, I was watching Nationals on WMUR late. Just woke up in time for the start of your show. Did Bill O'Brien win? Does Maggie have the House still? Liz also says she'll miss Carol Shea Porter. What can you tell us a little bit, Councillor Van Ostern, about what happened at the State House? So you said, for example, the Executive Council, where you serve, is now what, 3-2?
Yeah, so it's been 3-2 Democrat. It'll be 3-2 Republican now going forward. We had a popular longtime Democratic executive counselor who retired, and I don't think it was a particular shock to anyone that seat switched hands.
And which seat was that again?
And that was Deb Pignatelli down in Nashville.
Okay. And the Senate is still Republican. I believe they picked up a seat or two.
Yeah, it looks like there wasn't a significant change in the Senate. I think we went from 11 to 10 Democrats. But in terms of a governing majority, it's probably not going to make a dramatic impact in terms of the direction of the state. And in the House, it looks like Republicans made some pretty significant gains taking back the House, you know, with 400 seats, it, frankly, it takes a while. There'll probably be dozens of recounts. It's going to take a while to see the final total. But there's no question that Republicans will have control of the House and the Senate. And it's going to put a real onus on to all policymakers of finding areas of compromise that we can agree on, the outcomes we're striving for, to figure out how to move forward as a state.
Okay, Councilor Van Ostern, hang on for just a moment. I think Josh Rogers has a question for you.
Good morning. So what do you make of, you know, you say independence, and certainly there's some of that going on, but how much do you think it was, you know, popular Democrats at the top of the ticket and, you know, a better party organization that is more capable of winning elections, meaning the Democrats?
Yeah, well, I think there were a couple things going on. First, you really have to admire that the results that Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen and Annie Custer put up, particularly when you compare them to the final polls. I mean, the predictions out of UNH showed Shaheen and Hassan both might win by a point. I think we're looking at a 6-plus point lead for Hassan, maybe 4 points for Shaheen. So they're, you know, I think they both overperformed. You know, really, it's because their campaigns were, it wasn't an argument over the same issues. They were about fundamentally different issues. And what you heard Maggie Hassan and Jean Shaheen talking about was how we focus on what's important for our communities. They weren't talking about what you hear about on cable news. They were talking about what affects people in their home, in their community, how we can get jobs to the shipyard in Senator Shaheen's case, how we can foster innovation in Governor Hassan's case. I think by talking about what's unique to New Hampshire, it not only helped them win, but it's also a great path forward for progress. Because,
okay,
frankly, in a divided government, the most partisan issues, the Beltway issues, the cable news issues, it's going to be really hard for anyone to make progress on.
All right. Well, Colin Van Ostern, thank you for calling in this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And since that email from Liz and the call from Colin Van Ostern brought us to more state-based races, gentlemen, let's hear what Governor Hassan said last night about how she wants to approach her next term in the corner office.
It appears that the New Hampshire legislature will remain closely divided between Democrats and Republicans. 2 years ago, I said we should see this not as an obstacle, but as an opportunity to move beyond the partisan divide. That is exactly what we did, and that is exactly how we should move forward.
Okay, again, that's Governor Hassan declaring victory, going to a second term. Josh Rogers.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the final count in the House is, and who they end up electing Speaker. The person she mentioned most on the campaign trail wasn't Walt Havenstein, her Republican rival, but it's former House Speaker Bill O'Brien. He's was a sort of a catchphrase for Democrats, a rallying cry, who they didn't like his sort of abrasive leadership style and some of the policy changes, particularly deep cuts to the budget. He could be back as Speaker. We don't know who's going to be Speaker, and it's going to be a while, as Colin noted, before the exact numbers in the House shake out. And also in that governor's race, there was a lot of tough talk from Senate Republicans, with whom Governor Hassan worked pretty closely, particularly on the state budget that passes the Senate basically unanimously. There was a lot of talk from Senate Republicans that she was withholding financial information, and the sort of toxic partisanship is what Senate Finance Chair Jeanie Forrester wrote. You know, some of that's election season sort of stuff, but it's hard to believe that everyone's going to totally forget that. And so this is going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, it will be. And just very quickly, Ken, we talked about this last night, but nationally, how did Republican governors versus Democratic governors do?
Well, this is fascinating. I mean, the headlines, of course, is about the Senate takeover by the Republicans and how the Senate Republican candidates tied their opponents to President Obama. But look at some of the governors' races around the country that went for the Republicans. In Massachusetts, which is not an anti-Obama state, Charlie Baker beat Martha Coakley. In Maryland, which is a 2-1 Democratic state, Larry Hogan defeated Anthony Brown, who was the lieutenant governor and Bill Clinton and Obama campaigned for.
These are deeply blue states,
deeply
Ken.
Deeply blue states. And if you think of the states where Republicans were thought to be in trouble, with Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Rick Scott in Florida, again, they all won. A Republican governor who lost was Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania, but we knew from the beginning that he was in big trouble. He's actually the first Pennsylvania governor to lose re-election since as you will remember, 1842. But, I mean, we knew that was going to happen in Pennsylvania. But it's not even – it's too simple to say it's about anti-Obama or blaming the linking the opponents with President Obama. In many of these blue states, the Republicans triumphed as well.
And don't forget Governor Paul LePage in Maine. It was a little bit more complicated situation there. But, you know, about as controversial governors we have. And, you know, he won a lot more easily than people thought.
Yeah, and that's a three-way contest in Maine, right? Because
Cutler, the independent, right. Mike Mischa, the Democrat.
Okay, well, let's hear from the Republican nominee for governor. He had not run for election before. He came from the business world, as did Craig Benson, as did John Lynch. Let's hear a little bit from Walt Havenstein on his defeat last night.
We ran a campaign based on the idea that New Hampshire can do better. We know we can. That we can once again be the economic engine of the Northeast. It's the idea that what makes our state great is the opportunity to work hard and build a better life for you and your family. Our message was one of optimism and hope, that as Granite Staters, we can remake our own future and build an economy which will create opportunities to keep our young people here.
Again, that's Walt Havenstein, and he ran a decent race for governor. Didn't come in quite as far back, Josh Rogers, as some people thought he would.
No, and he came into this race not well known. He did pour a couple million dollars of his own money into it. And he ran on the economy and, you know, nothing terribly novel, restoring the so-called New Hampshire advantage. He
lowering
had a sort of,
taxes.
Pledge 2.0, as he called it, which would not simply be a pledge against, sales income tax, but also against, unfunded liabilities, basically. He didn't have a lot to work with, given that the budget, which was his main issue, was something that passed with Republican support, passed with the main people who were helping him get elected, the Senate Republicans, that Medicaid expansion was passed with Republican support, that a gas tax increase was passed with in a bipartisan manner. So, he did what he could, and I think he grew somewhat as a candidate, but it was a tough sledding for him.
It is always tough to unseat an incumbent governor here in New Hampshire, with the exception of Craig Benson a couple of years ago. Here's an email from Rob, who says, the big loser last night was Mr. Obama. The GOP control of the Senate means all those bills that are piled high on Harry Reid's desk will finally get a vote. Rob says many of them were passed by the House with bipartisan support. Some of them were even Democrat passed. Rob says when most of them pass, we will either get things moving in a new direction or the president will veto them and become the obstructor in chief. Democrats being seen as the barrier to progress can't benefit them in 2016. Thank you, Rob, for the email. So what do you think, Ken Rudin? This is sort of looking ahead at the big picture on Capitol Hill and how it all shakes out.
Well, I mean, Rob makes a point that the next 2 years could give the Republicans the opportunity to govern as they said they would, they promised to do. But the question is, what do the next 2 years look like? You could make the case, as Mitch McConnell and John Boehner have said, that maybe there are areas of agreement that we could work together on. But there's also the possibility that President Obama could be still frustrated by the Republican majority in the House and Senate and go on with his executive actions on immigration, on taxes, on things like that. And that would, of course, inflame and infuriate the Republican Party. And if you think the last 2 years or 4 years of gridlock have been tough, it'll be much worse if they're fighting each other for the remaining 2 years of his presidency.
And Ken, we were looking around this morning for some sort of comment from President Obama. Usually after a midterm, the president says, I'm sorry we lost, but congratulations to everybody and let's work together and so forth. We haven't found anything yet. We read that he's going on a trip to Asia.
Yeah, he's not the kind of guy who, like, when Reagan and the Republicans lost the Senate in 1986, or Bill Clinton lost the Democratic Congress in 1994, there was much more introspective comments from those two respective presidents. President Obama, again, is probably not somebody who's going to spend much time thinking about what happened in 2014, and he'll probably be looking to see what he can do to save his legacy and prepare for the next 2 years.
Sometimes it's said, Ken, and you're definitely much more of an expert expert on this than me, obviously. Sometimes it's said that a Democratic president or a Republican president is almost freed up by not having to worry about, you know, control of Congress and managing his majority. Sometimes it's said that, you know, it's almost easier because you can just sort of say what you think and not have to worry about the senators in the Democratic senators.
Well,
or the Democratic
Congress. President Obama doesn't have to run for another term again, so that frees him up. But look what happened to Bill Clinton in 1994 when the Republicans, the Newt Gingrich revolution in 94, when the Republicans took the House and the Senate, Bill Clinton had the opportunity to sit back and point fingers at the so-called obstructionist Congress. It's very possible, and maybe this is a Democratic pipe dream, but it's very possible that the Democrats can have the 2016 campaign to point to these obstructionists, these conservatives, these ultra-conservatives in Congress to say that we need a Democrat in the White House to stop the Mitch McConnell, John Boehner wing.
You know, what's interesting, too, Josh Rogers, is in the second congressional district race, which we haven't talked about that much yet, there was this, you know, Ann McClain Custer said she was Barack Obama's number one supporter in the state, and then she kind of dialed back from that. But that charge didn't seem to hurt her. She won pretty well last night.
She did. The second district is one that, you know, tilts a little more left than the first district. She was also running against a very conservative candidate, Marilinda Garcia, state lawmaker from Salem, who is pretty much a full bore conservative, albeit a young woman and of Hispanic heritage, sort of a different face that Republicans nationally thought had a real chance. And they did throw some money into it. Custer is a good fundraiser. She had money. And they, you know, the Democrats went after Garcia, as they said, her extreme record on, you know, abortion, on same-sex marriage, on the things she voted for in the House. And, you know, Garcia got a lot of hype. And we'll see if she's back. I mean, she was an interesting figure, certainly seen nationally as somebody who could help Republicans with some image problems. But, you know, Custer is, you know, she's had her rough patches in her first term, but, you know, she, you know, ran hard, and it's a district that's
a little that more
hasn't,
well,
hasn't really, there hasn't been a staunch conservative elected in that district since Chuck Douglas. And, you know, Custer did a good job to win, though.
Well, let's hear from Ann McClain Custer at her victory party last night.
Here's what I know to be true. In New Hampshire, folks are not asking for too much. A decent job with fair pay and benefits for working hard every single day. A home to rent or even call their own. To raise a family with opportunity for their children's future. And to retire with dignity and security. Just their little slice of the American dream.
Again, that's Ann McClain Custer, the victor in the second congressional district. Well, Ken Rudin, as we wrap up looking at the 2014 elections, and again, it was great to have you here in New Hampshire helping us out with that. I'm guessing we'll be seeing you pretty soon because the presidential primary is not that far away. How much of a break do we get? 48 hours, 72 hours
well,
before?
It's remarkable. In the little this morning, I was watching the talk shows and everything. And of course, you had Chris Christie on and you had Rand Paul on. And every question, when are you running? When are you announcing? So obviously, there's no time to sit back and appreciate what 2014 meant, what's going to be the next 2 years of governing, what that's going to be like. Immediately, we go into the 2016 presidential race. When is Hillary going to announce? Is it going to be a challenge from Elizabeth Warren? Which Republican is going to come up? It starts immediately.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah,
you but if it didn't, I mean, the reason that's good news is that you could have me on your show more often. That's very important.
Well, and in fact, the political junkie Ken Rudin does join us every month here on The Exchange. That's great. So, Ken, we'll talk to you again in about a month, and maybe we'll have some more thoughts about what's been happening in Congress and looking ahead to the presidential primary. Thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
And Josh Rogers, thank you also very much for your time. Long night last night. We really appreciate it.
Interesting one, though.
All right. Well, NHPR's Josh Rogers, our senior political reporter, Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, a weekly radio show covering national, state, and local politics. Again, he'll be back with us next month. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.